As you know, the days are getting shorter and darker and colder. It's the time of year when winter begins to creep in, and also the time of year when we look for things to make us feel a little more warm and comfortable. One of the best ways to do that is through a little dose of self-indulgence. The food writer and Morning Edition regular Nigella Lawson has some thoughts about self-indulgence. She joins us from London to talk about them. Hi, Nigella.
Hello. I'm very, very pro-self-indulgence. I'll be up front now.
I had a feeling you might be, although we should emphasize that in the United States, self-indulgence, I mean, kind of got that Puritan heritage over here. It's considered bad.
It is considered bad. And in a way, you could say that only heightens the pleasure. So your negativity is not entirely negative, we should say. I mean, I think that we feel that self-indulgence is bad for two reasons. I think one, that people are kind of diet obsessed. And the other, of course, as you say, it's a puritanical feeling that somehow if you enjoy yourself, there must be some moral slackness.
Well, let's just dive into some moral slackness here, if we might. Because once again, our colleague, Courtney Dorning, has baked one of your recipes here. And just at first glance, it looks like a cross between a pancake and a toasted cheese sandwich. I believe it's called donut French toast. What is it?
Yeah. Okay, that's fine. It's the right sort of color.
Oh, my God.
Really,
it's amazing.
It's really...
Excuse me. This is just amazing. It's like a donut, but it's French toast. But go on, please.
Yeah,
please.
No, well, I think the reason why I think of it as a sort of donut is because the egginess and the vanilla come through, and
yes,
then you put sugar on top like a donut. And there's something, I don't know whether this is true, but someone once said to me that vanillin, which is the thing that makes vanilla smell like it does, is present in breast milk.
Oh.
So we have some very primitive desire to be comforted by the taste of vanilla. I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm just telling you. So you could say it's a kind of Freudian self-indulgence.
I had a mouthful of it when you were saying that. It's really more than I needed to know. But thank you anyway. I appreciate it. It does taste like it's got almost like a donut glaze on it. It really is quite a treat. It's really great.
Well, sugar, you know, sugar is enormously comforting. And I say that as someone who finds all food comforting, including savory foods.
So how do you find a balance, or do you even try, between enjoying something a little rich from time to time and actually, you know, going overboard and being unhealthy?
Well, I think the balance is much easier to maintain if you don't deny yourself all the time. I think people who forbid themselves to eat anything that's been fried or that has butter are the ones that suddenly manage to eat tubs and tubs of ice cream.
Mm.
Whereas I think the body is self-regulating. There are times when you want something fried and then you feel like a very light soup or a plate of steamed vegetables. I mean, I actually feel I eat very healthily. My only problem is I eat enough for five healthy people. That's
it's a
portion control issue. But I do think it is okay to eat foods that the dietitians say don't eat. I also think that one should make a real distinction between self-indulgent foods that are real foods and processed foods which have all sorts of things in them which aren't good for you. So as long as you're cooking proper food for yourself, I don't think you need to feel so bad about it.
Well, that's interesting. It sounds a little like Michael Pollan, who's been in this program many times, talking
yes.
about, you know, something that feels natural, something that your grandmother would recognize as a food rather than a
yeah.
food product of some kind.
No, I think he's quite right there.
Now, you've also got, if you don't mind, I'm going to eat the other piece of this donut French toast.
Carry on, crunching.
And as I do that, yes, it does have a crunch to it. It's really really crispy. It's great. I wonder if you could describe another recipe you've got here. I don't know if this would go with a donut French toast, but if you would describe the cheddar cheese risotto, please.
I would be delighted to. I don't think it does go with it, but I think it has a lot in common, even though, of course, the ingredients are very, very different, which is, I suppose, self-indulgent foods are reminiscent of the tastes we loved in childhood. So just like the eggs and the milk and the sugar in the donut French toast, the cheese risotto, the cheese melts and becomes sort of gooey. So I suppose it's like a slightly grown-up grilled cheese sandwich. But there's something about carbohydrate, which you cannot beat carbohydrate for comfort. And even though I at first felt, I felt bad about, you know, the Italians, and why am I putting cheddar mm-hmm. in a risotto? But an Italian friend of mine says that whenever she goes back to Italy, they ask her to bring cheddar back because, of course, for them, they make a choice between cheese that has a flavour or cheese that goes gooey. Now, cheddar has a strong flavour and also goes gooey, so it's kind of perfect.
Hmm. But not something that would be on a traditional Italian plate.
Oh, not at all. But I think that my notion of self-indulgence perhaps isn't entirely the same as everyone else's. And what I love about this dish is you can sneak a few minutes in the kitchen and just stir. And sometimes I find that the best way to switch off. So I'm really in my own little world stirring something and then I'm eating it. I do think also anything that can be eaten out of a bowl with a spoon is a fantastic self-indulgence. No cutting, no chewing.
Mm, there you go. Excuse me, I was just chewing some more of the donut French toast there. Is there anything to avoid when you're putting together some self-indulgent food like this?
Well, I'm afraid there probably are things you should avoid, but I don't know that I know how to. I suppose you don't want to have them every day. You don't want it to be a pile-up. And also, I think sometimes people confuse comfort eating with misery. So there is no point in indulging yourself if you're going to persecute yourself at the same time. That is what you have to avoid.
What do you mean?
If you don't enjoy it because you think I shouldn't be eating this, then don't. If you can wallow in the pleasure of every single mouthful, then you're doing something good. And then I think then somehow it's healthier. No, it's not healthier, it doesn't make any difference nutritionally, but I think the mind is important as well as the body.
Nigella Lawson, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Nigella Lawson is the author of several cookbooks, including most recently Nigella Christmas. And if you'd like to indulge yourself at home, both of these recipes are on our website, npr.org.
After the birth of his son, the novelist Jonathan Safran Foer started asking questions about food.
I simply wanted to know, for myself and my family, what meat is. I wanted to know as concretely as possible. Where does it come from? How is it produced? How are animals treated, and to what extent does that matter? What are the economic, social, and environmental effects of eating animals? My personal quest didn't stay that way for long. Through my efforts as a parent, I came face to face with realities that as a citizen I couldn't ignore, and as a writer I couldn't keep to myself.
That's Jonathan Safran Foer reading from his new book, Eating Animals. Now, if you think it's an anti-meat screed or just an impassioned case for vegetarianism, it isn't. Though the publication of the book has already irritated the meat and poultry industry and prompted actress Natalie Portman to declare herself a vegan. Jonathan Safran Foer is also the author of the acclaimed novel Everything is Illuminated, and he joins me from our New York studios. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
How important was meat in your life, in sort of the cultural life that you were a part of as a kid?
I would say meat had considerable importance, and in different ways. I loved the way it tasted. I loved the way it smelled. I continue to love the way it smells. And I'm pretty sure if I were to eat it again, I would love the way it tasted. Meat also had a real cultural value in my family and my upbringing. It was how we celebrated the 4th of July. It was how we celebrated Thanksgiving. And I looked forward to that, and I loved it. And my ideas about Thanksgiving, it's very, very hard to extricate that turkey from my ideas about Thanksgiving.
Well, what do you do on Thanksgiving now?
I have all those great foods that we used to have just without a turkey. The point of Thanksgiving is not to be rigid. It's not to follow somebody else's idea of what Thanksgiving is. It's to bring family together, celebrate together, feel grateful together, and transmit values from one generation to the next. Whether or not there's chicken stock in the gravy has nothing to do with those things I just said. Having a conversation about what we believe in, that to me has everything to do with Thanksgiving.
I want to ask you about the research you did, because you did visit several farms over the course of working on this book.
I would challenge any listener of this program to visit the kind of farm that raises more than 99% of the animals that become our food. It is impossible.
And you actually tried to visit a plant that supplies meat to Tyson's, and Tyson's never replied.
Well, Tyson's, there's no need to single them out. I mean, I sent dozens and dozens of letters to all of the major, you know, agribusiness corporations asking to visit their farms. You know, if I wrote a letter to the producer of my son's apple juice and I said, you know, I've been feeding this stuff to my son every day. I'm kind of curious. Where does it come from? How is it made? I'd be able to go see the orchard. If I wanted to know about the bagels I feed my son for breakfast, The guys in the deli would let me around the other side of the counter. They'd show me the ovens. They showed me their ingredients. Why is this the great exception? And what does it say? What does it say that there's an entire industry that is set up that asks us to give them money, asks us to ingest in our bodies and feed to our children a product whose production they won't let us see?
You visited a place called the Good Shepherd Turkey Ranch, and you profile a man named Frank Rees, the owner. And you describe this ranch as an example of a place where ethical meat is produced. The question I have about this place is that his meat isn't necessarily affordable for many Americans. It can cost 5 to 7 times the price of, you know, say, a rotisserie chicken at the supermarket. So what do you say to people who make the argument there's a little bit of elitism here?
Well, you referred to the kind of meat that you would buy in the supermarket, and factory farms are happily tell this a similar story, that it's cheap and that Frank's meat is expensive. It's not true. I mean, it's true if you're only looking at the price at the cash register. Factory farming has externalized all of their costs. Who do you think pays? If factory farming is, if animal agriculture is the number one cause of global warming, who pays for that? You think we don't pay for it? You think they're going to ultimately pay for it? Who pays for the decimation of land value across America, which has been a very direct effect of factory farming? Who pays for the water pollution? Who pays for the air pollution? And by the way, who pays for the cost of the human health costs?
Most people going to the supermarket looking to make an affordable, relatively healthy dinner for their families are not going to be thinking about land values and about global warming at that point. I mean, can you blame them?
I mean, clearly what has to happen is people have to eat less meat. Americans have been convinced of a diet that is, frankly, unnatural and not what our parents ate, not what our grandparents ate.
I mean, they ate meat.
Americans now eat 150 times as much chicken as they did 80 years ago. When, you know, factory farms talk about feeding the world, they're not talking about feeding hungry people. They're talking about producing incredibly cheap meat and finding wider and wider audiences who are willing to eat more and more and more of it.
You make it clear, right, from the outset that you're not judging the decisions other people make, right? I mean, if people choose to eat meat, you're not judging them.
No.
Or are you, in a sense? I mean, because you argue that eating meat is the single worst thing that a person can do to the environment.
That is a well-established fact. I, in my own life, do all kinds of things that are bad for the environment, and I am a terrible hypocrite in all kinds of ways. And furthermore, I'm not altogether sure what I think about a lot of these issues when it boils right down to it. I do think that there are some baseline things that we should all agree on, the most important being that eating meat matters. It's the number one cause of global warming. The UN and Pew Commissions have said that it is among the top 2 or 3 causes of every significant environmental problem, locally and globally, air pollution, water pollution. So if this is the most important way that we interact with the environment, if it's the most important way that we interact with animals, then our decisions when we go to a restaurant, what to order, when we go to a supermarket, what to buy, these decisions aren't passing. They can't be casual. You know, what we choose to eat when ordering in a restaurant, what we choose to buy at a supermarket is frankly the most important decision, or at least one of the very most important decisions we'll make all day.
Jonathan Safran Foer's new book is called Eating Animals. He spoke with us from New York, Jonathan Safran Foer. Thanks from New York, Jonathan Safran Foer. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Halloween tonight. Our two daughters are going as Simone de Beauvoir and Sheila Bair, chairwoman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Well, not really. They're going to be ballet dancer fairy princesses. But 'tis the season to be scary, and the venerable Library of America has just issued a 2-volume set, American Fantastic Tales, Terror and the Uncanny. Volume 1 from Poe to the Pulps, Volume 2 from 1940 to now. It's edited by Peter Straub, who's won the Bram Stoker Award and the International Horror Guild Award for a career that includes the novels Ghost Story and The Hellfire Club and several collaborations with Stephen King. Peter Straub joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a real pleasure, Scott.
What a blinding array of names almost, from Poe to Stephen Crane, Bret Hart. So what moved you to choose a story?
Well, a number of things. I wanted to get a good representation of stories from across the decades, from as early as possible to the present. And so for every generation, I I wanted to find people who wrote well in this genre. And otherwise, I was looking for really, really good stories. In some cases, when I got into the pulps, I was looking for very bizarre stories of the sort that only flourished in pulp fiction.
Like
this terrific, absolutely goofy story by a man named David H. Keller called The Jellyfish. It's about a genius mad scientist who brags to his students that he can shrink himself down to the size of an amoeba and does so. And as they watch through the microscope, this posturing, arrogant character is in a drop of water, and he moves inside a thing that looks like a jellyfish, and then he discovers that he can't get out, and he's banging on the skin of the thing.
Oh.
And they see him gradually disappear until he has been totally digested.
Oh!
So, I mean, that's irresistible. Really. Oh.
I made a note. I loved Melville's story. I'd never read Herman Melville, The Tartarus of Maids.
Yeah, that's
very
interesting.
And if I may, I don't think I've ever read a scarier sentence than this.
Huh.
Two of the girls, dropping their rags, plied each a whetstone up and down the sword blade. My unaccustomed blood curdled at the sharp shriek of the tormented steel.
Oh, oh boy. Oh. Yeah, there we go.
Clearly a master.
Yeah.
Did you spare some authors from being forgotten in this anthology?
Well, I'm glad you put it that way, because that's my conviction. Mm-hmm. I had to do a lot of research, and it took about 2 years for me to read through a sufficiency of stories located sometimes very odd places, old pulp magazines, old libraries. And there were people I came across who had been famous at one point. These are mainly women. Mm-hmm. I am speaking of Olivia Howard Dunbar and Alice Brown and Mary Wilkins Freeman.
I read an Emma Frances Dawson I liked.
Yeah, Emma Frances Dawson. I mean,
An Itinerant House.
She only published one book. She was a protege of Ambrose Bierce. She was in the great earthquake of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And after that, she stopped writing. She moved to Palo Alto, and she became a kind of a reclusive piano teacher. So she had not been well known, but these other women had been. And I felt really as though I was kind of disinterring them and giving them a chance to shine again. It was a very satisfying feeling.
Mm. And what's satisfying about horror fiction?
Oh, its appeal to parts of oneself that aren't normally reached. The fact that it opens up a kind of realm of experience which is deeply valuable in itself as a method of learning more and more about life, but which is generally overlooked or ignored. In America, we don't like darkness, really.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an immense quantity to be learned there, and we all experience it in our lives.
Mm. Has the idea of what can frighten us, make us sleepless at night, changed with technology?
Yeah, sure. There are more opportunities now. I mean, you could write a wingding story about cell phones or computers, and I'm sure a lot of people have. There's a great and very strange story by Harlan Ellison in here.
I Have No Mouth?
I Have No Mouth and I'm a Scream.
My gosh, what a story this is.
That's an astonishing story. And it's about what Harlan saw as the potential for threat in these massive computers that were just being built at MIT at the time he wrote the story.
And it's breathlessly contemporary now, just mm-hmm. thinking the computers are smaller, but they're even,
yeah,
more,
that's right. That's
even
right.
more frightening. Before we get to our last question, final sentence that I read in this anthology that I want to share.
Yeah.
You've done a wonderful two-volume anthology, but if the family's going to curl up with a story tonight, anyone you'd like to recommend?
Oh, let me see here. Oh, you know what? There's a very funny, rather grisly story by the great George Sanders mm-hmm. called Sea Oak. If their children are teenagers, they might like Stephen Milhauser's Dangerous Laughter, which is about a fad of laughter that gets out of control in a high school in a small town.
Oh, that sounds great. I missed that
story.
I'll pick it up now.
Yeah.
Peter Straub, editor of the Library of America's two-volume anthology, American Fantastic Tales, Terror and the Uncanny. Mr. Straub, nice talking to you.
Very good. Talk to you, too.
And you can read a review of American Fantastic plus an excerpt from Charles Brockden Brown's creepy story, Somnambulism, a fragment, on our website, npr.org.